It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfworth. Alaska presents a lot of challenges. Tall mountains, wild rivers, long treks, mosquitoes. We talk about all of them on the show. But the biggest challenge of Alaska might be the one it presents to artists. Who would dare try to represent the grandeur of our wilderness on a two-dimensional canvas or in words on a page? Today, in honor of the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act, we're talking with artists who have been put into the wilderness with the goal of bringing it back in paint, words, and photographs, and a Forest Service person whose job it is to make those trips happen. And I've got a great panel, and I'm looking forward to participating as well as an artist who's written a lot about Alaska. On the phone with us from Portland, I believe, is Amy Gulick, who's the author and photographer of Salmon in the Trees, beautiful, extraordinary book published by Braided River Press. Amy, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
And Barbara Lydon is with the U.S. Forest Service. She's a coordinator of the pardon me, Voices of the Wilderness Project, which is a project that places artists and writers in the wilderness so that they can be inspired. Thanks for being with us.
It's Barbara. My pleasure. Thanks, Charles.
And Susan Watkins dropped what she was doing today, which was painting a mural at the new Bass Pro Shop here in Anchorage, so that she could come and talk to us about art in the wilderness and how you try to take these beautiful places and put them on a canvas. Thanks for being with us, Susan.
Well, you're welcome. I'm delighted to be here.
And your work is so beautiful. And, you know, I think it's extraordinary. We put a picture, a painting of yours, My View, up on our website. And people can find that at alaskapublic.org. Just go to the show Art Inspired by the Wilderness. And it looks like the front of your kayak, yellow kayak, is paddling along calm waters. I'm guessing this is Prince William Sound, maybe College Fjord?
Correct, near College Fjord, right around the corner.
Tell us about creating this painting.
That's the view that I experienced so much during my trip when I went out with Barbara Lydon with the Voices of Wilderness program a couple years ago. And that was in front of me so many times during my experience. And so that image was there, that feeling, that space in front of me, just me and the kayak, you know, a little bit of my gear. Mm-hmm. And then that inspiration, that view. And I had to take that with me. Obviously, I took a lot of photographs, but also as I'm out there, I also do little notes and color studies and all so that I could capture that brilliant color and the reflections and so forth.
Well, you do capture it, and it looks very much like what it really looks like, and I could instantaneously recognize it. And yet it also has a certain heightened quality to it that you wouldn't get in a photograph, which is it's kind of luminous or dreamy a little bit, and there's this way you've used paint, not trying to pick out every detail, but suggest the details of what's in the image. And it seems like that must be a tremendous challenge because there'd be this desire to make it look exactly like it looks because it's so beautiful, but you also have to put yourself into it.
True. And I think that when you can paint on location or try to capture images on location, it is more than just a photograph. You're correct. Mm-hmm. When you can paint and right there and kind of get the light exactly as and also capture kind of the moment, that feeling. So that's what I tried to recreate.
Yeah. And in these murals that you're doing, you're kind of trying to bring those places to an indoor space.
Exactly.
Tell us about the mural you're working on right now at the Bass Pro Shop.
Well, they have asked me as an Alaskan artist representative, and I'm delighted that they're including me in their projects, is that to represent an Alaska area where it's the archery range, actually, that I've been painting. So I chose to depict the tundra. Mm-hmm. Where a lot of guys go up to bow hunt and gals, of course, the Brooks Range, that wide open space of tundra. And imagine I have a 100-foot wall.
Oh, my gosh.
Bilateral, you know, parallel walls. So you want to walk in there and just feel like you are out there. You got that space. I've got caribou in the distance coming over the ridge. I've got one up close that they could miss. And critters, you know, some falcon and so forth. The feeling of life around it, but then those rocky, rugged crevices and distant mountains and the hues of the tundra.
Right.
Which I just love, too, from having backpacked out there a
the
few times.
The colors are so important. Mm-hmm. Wow, I want to talk more as we go on about the challenges of painting on such an immense scale. That's got to be very difficult. But I want to bring Amy Gulick into our conversation. Amy did this book, Salmon in the Trees, which is it has a book with a purpose, right? Amy, you're not just expressing yourself, but you're also trying to make a point about this place that we live in.
Correct. Salmon in the Trees is all about Southeast Alaska, and I'm using this remarkable ecological connection between salmon and trees to help people understand what makes that particular ecosystem so abundant, so just incredibly rich, and so special and unique, and not just in Alaska, but in the world.
And the explanation of the title is that the nutrients that come up the river by spawning salmon end up in the tops of the trees, right? Because they feed the forest.
Yep, exactly. And scientists have actually been able to take tree core samples out of trees near spawning streams and detect incredibly high amounts of what's called nitrogen-15. And it's a nitrogen variant that comes from the ocean. And they've been able to determine that it comes in the, you know, it's brought in the bodies of salmon, delivered to the forest floor by bears, and then drawn into the roots of plants.
Amazing. It's such a poetic and a symbolic thing for you to be portraying, and so a great idea for the title of your book. Do you have a conservation goal with the book? Is there something that you're trying to convey that in terms of political agenda or something you want to see happen in creating this work?
Yeah, you know, that's a good way to phrase it. There are definitely things I would like to see happen, but more importantly, what I don't want to see happen is what happened in the Lower 48 with the salmon and the forests in a very, very similar ecosystem. It was just kind of stream by stream, forest stand by forest stand. We lost all that. You know, whether we dammed our, you know, greatest river systems, like, say, on the Columbia River, or, you know, we logged all the old-growth forests, which we now know are key to salmon habitat as well as other wildlife habitat. So, I mean, for me, I wouldn't say I have a political agenda. It's kind of a two-pronged message. It's one, you know, the first is just, wow, what an incredible ecosystem we still have in Southeast Alaska. So it's a celebration in that respect. And then number two, maybe kind of serves as, you know, just maybe a little bit of a warning. It's like, look, we had these things in droves in other parts of North America, but we don't have them anymore. So let's be careful how we go forward.
And so you enter into this work, going into the field with your camera and with your notebook, with this very big thing you're trying to express. Sounds like quite the challenge. I mean, I guess you have to take it one piece at a time.
Definitely. It's like, yeah, one second at a time, especially when you're in wilderness areas. And I think it's interesting, you know, you had mentioned how, you know, how on earth do any artist, you know, how do we go into, you know, such a vast, you know, place like Alaska and create and not be overwhelmed? And I think that's a really good question. And what I find for me, I actually feel the opposite. When I go into these vast, wild places that Alaska is so full of, I don't feel overwhelmed. I think for me, the feeling is humbled, and I think there's a very big distinction. I think overwhelmed for me would be, you know, just kind of stressed and at my wit's end. I don't even know what to do. Humbled for me is, it's like, you know, I feel very small, I feel insignificant, but yet I feel like I'm a part of this huge, vast, incredible, you know, thriving world. And for me, when I feel like that, and that's what wilderness does for me, I feel calm, I feel at peace, and I feel at home. And I also feel incredibly in the present. And when you're living in the moment, in the present, for an artist, and I think really for all of us, that's when you think clearly. I think that's when the world makes the most sense. And again, for me, it's just, there's no place that I would rather be, no place in my mind, you know, than being in the present, and then no place, you know, again, just by being out in a wild area. It's I'm not sure if I'm explaining that correctly.
You're explaining it beautifully, and I totally identify with what you're talking about. And I want to talk about that much more as the show goes on. So stick with us, listeners. We'll have lots of good philosophical, psychological, and anthropological thoughts about how the wilderness impacts our art as creators. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Woolforth. We're talking about art in the wilderness on today's show with two artists, Susan Watkins, who's a painter and muralist, and Amy Gulick, who you just heard from, a photographer and writer. And Barbara Lydon is with me. She works with the U.S. Forest Service, a longtime wilderness ranger, and also coordinator of the Voices of Wilderness program, which, along with the Park Service, takes artists out into the wilderness for extended expeditions so they can get inspired. And one of the reasons we're doing today's show is because the Wilderness Act is having its 50th anniversary. The Wilderness Act is a law that I guess we have to thank for a lot of these places that we can still enjoy as outdoors lovers. And there's, in fact, a forum that's taking place next Tuesday. And it's at the Wilda Marston Theater at the Lusac Library, 3600 Denali Street, for anyone who doesn't know where the library is. This is on Tuesday, April 15th, tax day. Doors open at 6, and the program begins at 6:30. There will be a bunch of tables there. A lot of conservation organizations are involved, as well as public land organizations. And there are a couple of panel discussions, which it just coincidentally I'm moderating, and Susan is going to be on one of the panels. And just talking about wilderness values, a conversation about Alaska's wilderness values. Barbara, tell us, if you would, about what is the Wilderness Act and why is it worthy of a 50th anniversary celebration?
Yeah, so the Wilderness Act was signed by Lyndon Johnson on September 3rd of 1964, and what that did was establish the National Wilderness Preservation System and defined what a wilderness area is. Wilderness areas are special places. They're just truly unique. Wilderness areas are defined as areas that are untrammeled or uncontrolled by people. So in a wilderness area, you typically won't find development, such as permanent structures or roads. You typically won't find mechanized or motorized uses. So these are areas that are valued by diverse communities and by lots of different people. People go to these areas to experience solitude. They go to these areas to get lost and to find themselves. They go to wilderness areas to observe wildlife or to simply breathe clean air. So they're really special.
And I guess in 1964, Congress and the president decided to have this designation, and there are certain areas that are designated wilderness. But then in a sort of our imagination and probably in our discussion, wilderness has a broader meaning. I guess it has probably a different meaning for everyone as to what is wilderness. It could be sort of the undeveloped lot at the end of your neighborhood street, right? But it's also this place that's safe and it's not going to be changed.
Exactly. It takes an act of Congress to designate a wilderness area. And the idea is to preserve these primitive places for future generations to remain untouched and in their natural state.
Mm-hmm. So now the Forest Service and the Park Service have a program, this Voices of Wilderness, which essentially is something that I don't think many people would sort of think of there being. But you're taking artists out there, and how do you do this, and how long do these trips go on, and what do you hope to get out of it?
Yeah, Charles, It's an incredible program. Basically, the idea is that the Voices of the Wilderness Artist Residency is modeled after traditional national parks residencies, but with a twist in that the artist accompanies a wilderness ranger. And the program is...
So it's a trek, and as a wilderness ranger, you're paddling around the sound, and or you're hiking, or you're floating a river. You're doing what we would do as outdoors people.
Yeah. You're a wilderness ranger for a week or 9 days. And we have, every year, we have different opportunities, and each one of those opportunities is different. One residency, you might be traveling by sea kayak, and camping alongside tidewater glaciers and counting harbor seals, whereas another residency, you might be floating down a river and pulling invasive weeds. Others might involve hiking and collecting lichen for biomonitoring air quality sampling.
So the ranger who's accompanying the artist has a project that they're trying to accomplish, most likely, and the artist is along, help with the project, and then also create.
Yes, the objective is to engage artists in stewardship projects, and typically it's, you know, it could be many, many different projects throughout the course of a week and a half.
Uh-huh. So, Susan, you've been on a number of these trips. To give us an example of what one would be like.
Well, when I went out with Barbara, for me, let me just back up a moment and just say, it not just as an artist, but to be educated in general on what the Park Service does, what the forest rangers do in protecting environments, what their field missions are. This I didn't really have a lot of knowledge of. So when I went out with Barbara, I got to participate in some of the programs and see what they do right on, you know, on location, from pulling invasive weeds to naturalizing campsites. For instance, hunters or other folks might have been out there and had a fire ring, and we do return the environment back to where it was. So then when somebody else comes along, not that that's wrong that they did, but when somebody else comes along, it's completely pristine. It's they're getting that wilderness feel again. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not seeing the trace of somebody being there before them. So definitely the emphasizing of leave no trace practice is there.
Does that work aspect of the trip enhance what you're doing?
Yes. Or? Oh, sure. I'm privileged to be there, and so I feel like I'm acting like a steward as well.
Mm-hmm.
So seeing what they're doing, and then also, you know, it was informative to me, things that I didn't think about before, like, you know, the invasive weed problem and so forth. Also, when I was out there, there was a group of teachers there with young adults and youth. And so I got to bear witness to what they were showing them and what they were learning as well, and work alongside them.
Uh-huh. So your art supplies are stuffed into kayaks?
Yes,
somewhere?
Sir.
So what do you, I mean,
it's amazing that you can get in that little hole.
I'm assuming you're not like laying out a 6-foot-wide canvas and trying to paint on the beach.
No.
Tell us what is your work practice when you're out there in terms of your art?
As a plein air painter, there's a lot of ways to adapt our tools to go into the outdoors. For me, I just roll my brushes up, and it's oil, okay, that I like to take. I roll the brushes in one little container, and then I have a little kit that has a palette and a tripod. It's just like a camera-type tripod. It's very light, so it's kind of all parts that you can put together, assemble. And then the oil paints, just a limited palette, just enough to work from, mm-hmm. in those small tubes of oil paint, and in containers, in sealed containers, I've taken my walnut oil and a little bit of turpentine that I can mix in my paint thinner. And then I took a little case that had about 7 or 8 small panels,
mm-hmm.
little linen panels that I can work on. And then that case is set up. You can buy them like this or make your own, where they're divided and they don't make contact with each other, and
right.
So you can take a wet canvas back with you. And all that can individually fit inside the front of the kayak.
And so you're doing little studies on these, uh-huh. and presumably taking pictures to refresh your memory.
Yeah. As well.
So how do you deal with the fact that it's raining a large part of the time when you're out there?
It was, but that's okay, because I wanted to capture some of that too. And it is oil. And a couple of times I know Barbara found me ducked under a little tree at the sound or something.
Uh-huh.
So. But we also, you know, I have an umbrella for other times that I'm out there doing this, but uh-huh. I didn't take anything like that with me. But we had a tarp. In fact, one point, she helped me out. She set me up with a tarp right on the beach when we were in front of Surprise Glacier. And I just ducked under that with my little canvas and painted away.
Yeah. You know, when I'm out there, sometimes I'm so tired that I don't really have the energy to write. And I don't know how that would affect you as an artist. I mean, when you're really out on an outdoor trek, sometimes it seems like, oh, the day's over. I've just done the minimum necessities of life. Now I'm exhausted. I'm ready to go to sleep. Do you ever feel that way?
Our experience was I felt very energized. Just thrilled, I think, was part of it. I was running on high energy, as we all were. And also, they paced it so that if I wanted to stop for a while for a location for hours, I could.
Mm-hmm.
When she had an intern with her, went over to look at the seal population, for instance, they were checking that out. I stayed on one side and painted away for hours. So I didn't really feel exhausted or tired at all during that time. I felt like that they paced everything perfectly, and I could get a lot out of the moment.
Little technical question: oil paints involve a lot of hazardous materials. Was that a concern, or how you were going to handle that stuff and keep it out of the environment?
It's not really. Well, first of all, what I'm taking is walnut oil.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the mediums I use, and then a paint thinner, and I had a little container, like a stainless steel or metal container with a screw-on lid.
I got you.
And that stayed in the dry bag.
So it's just keep everything contained.
So I don't think I left a drop.
Uh-huh.
I tried not.
Right. Leave no trace, leave no paint.
Right. Right. Leave no paint. Mostly it's on me anyhow.
Uh-huh. I hear you. So, Amy, you have these extraordinary pictures of salmon above the water, under the water. You must have some challenges when you're on an expedition of a gear challenge as well, keeping your gear safe and getting set up to take these extraordinary pictures. How do you manage that? That's something I think a lot of listeners would be interested in, because a lot of our listeners are backpacking and sea kayaking and trying to take good pictures, and you always sort of debate, like, how big of a camera do I take, how much equipment do I take, all that. How do you handle those issues?
Right. Oh, it's always a challenge. And I, you know, I think when I finally find the perfect solution, I probably won't be on the planet anymore. it's never easy. And especially in, you know, when I was working on my book, Salmon in the Trees, I mean, that's in southeast Alaska, which is, I think, one of the rainiest places in the entire state. And I think there's a reason why so many of the photographs that you do see from many photographers in Southeast were taken on one of those incredibly rare bluebird days, you know, of a stunning glacier or a breaching whale, because I think part of that is because of the gear.
You know, right, keeping
like,
the gear.
Oh, wow,
time,
I can finally get my gear out and not, you know, risk it being flooded. But what I quickly learned, and it's definitely applied to my residency in Nellie Wong College Fjord Wilderness Study Area in Prince William Sound as well, because we had pretty rainy weather there too. It wasn't monsooning, but you know, it's wet enough to certainly do damage to equipment. But what I found, and I always call it the windshield wiper test. So you know, when you're, and I'm pretty convinced that intermittent windshield wipers were invented in Southeast Alaska and probably in Prince William Sound area.
Yeah, you never have to turn them off.
Well, right. So you know, if it's raining hard enough and the windshield wipers are on, like, full tilt, then that's really too wet for me to be doing much of anything. And it's not so much the gear. I mean, it is. I mean, the gear is going to get wet and possibly ruined. But you really, I mean, how do you even make good images in weather like that? But, you know, if it's raining to where, say, the windshield wipers could be on intermittent, you know, they're just sometimes, you know, like there's an interval in which they're going back and forth. I could be out on a day like that. And I was out on many, many days like that. And the beauty about Southeast and what I found in Prince William Sound, where we were too, if it's starting to rain a little too hard, you duck underneath, you know, one of those magnificent old trees. It is amazing how dry you can be in the forest there.
And
there's amazing things you can do, you know, just like underneath a tree. And the other thing that I really have come to love is the kind of light that is famous in Southeast Alaska and in Prince William Sound. Mm-hmm. I prefer those misty, overcast, kind of what I like to call bright overcast days.
Mm-hmm.
Give me those light conditions any day over, you know, a perfect sunny day. I think I can make much more meaningful and impactful photographs in light like that. And I find that light absolutely beautiful. And it's indicative of the wilderness areas in those parts of the state anyway.
It's kind of indirect. It's not harsh. It's got a sort of a softness
very
to it.
Very soft.
But hopefully
very,
it's...
Yeah, very
I've been out there some days
and
when
you
it's
know,
almost like midnight, though, so you couldn't be too good at too many thick, too thick of clouds. So tell me quick about your... carrying this gear in your kayak and keeping it dry. Any suggestions about what kind of containers to use or how to keep your stuff safe while you're out kayaking or out in the weather?
I mean, kayaking, I think, is one of the more difficult ways to try and manage a lot of camera gear. Just because the best way to protect, and especially waterproof camera gear, is in a hard, like a Pelican case.
Mm-hmm.
For me, that is the best. But you're not going to fit one of those, say, between your legs or in the little round hatch of a kayak. So there, right off the bat, you've just got to start making some decisions about what gear you're going to take and what you're going to leave behind. And then you just deal with those decisions and deal with the gear that you've brought. And so in that case, when I'm traveling by kayak, it's going to be a soft-sided bag. And usually, I know everybody likes to call them dry bags, but I call them drip bags. Because I've never really found a dry. Sometimes they work great, and sometimes they drip. But you know what I've really found works really well is a dry bag lined with a trash compactor bag. Those trash compactor bags are probably the best, most bomb-proof plastic bags I can find. So put one of those in the dry bag, put the gear inside that, pad it with like fleece and clothing or, you know, things that I have to use for some other use. And that's the other thing, when you need to travel light, everything has to serve at least two purposes.
Mm-hmm.
If not, you know, so clothing is going to serve as padding, and, you know, something else is going to, you know, a trekking pole might serve as, you know, a makeshift tripod or, you know, whatever it is that you need to do. But yeah, so kayak, for me, that's the best thing, is those compactor bags inside a drip bag.
Well, I found that, you know, I've got all my stuff safely packed away, and then I want to take a picture, and takes so long to unpack it that, you know, you almost don't even bother trying. So it's sort of like, you know, you have to say, oh, today is going to be a day when I'm going to look for some pictures and keep your gear out. And then the next day when it's maybe a little wetter or you have a different focus, you don't even take it out. And for a pro like you, you're always thinking about pictures. But it seems like it takes so long to get your stuff in and out in those kinds of conditions that it's pretty hard to take advantage of a situation.
Right. Yes, that's very true, and I found that not only in a kayak, but in other situations as well. Sometimes I'm so worried about the gear, and I packed it so well that when an opportunity presents itself, you're like, oh my gosh, you know, the effort it's going to take to get all that gear out, you know, the moment will be gone. But I've kind of found a combo to this. Either I'm using the kayak or the canoe or the raft or however I'm traveling, I'll use it strictly as a mode of transportation, say to get from one place to another where I can actually get out and then start focusing on photographing. Because sometimes when you're paddling, you'd better be focusing on paddling. Otherwise, you might, you know,
take a long time to get there. Yeah.
Right. Somewhere where you don't want to be. So you just kind of have to be in, like, I think, different, you know, different modes in your mind. It's like, okay, I am paddling now, and yes, I'm seeing incredible opportunities, you know, going before me, but I've got to get over to that patch of island so I can get out and do this. Or, you know, if I'm feeling like I'm in a pretty safe situation, you know, it's calm, then I will have the camera out, and I will be focusing more on, you know, trying to make pictures, say, from whether it's the kayak or the canoe or whatever kind of platform I'm on. But yes, it's always a trade-off, and it's always a toss-up, and it can be incredibly frustrating.
Yeah. Well, if it was easy, right, they wouldn't need us. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Walforth, and we're talking about art in the wilderness. It's the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act, and that inspired us to bring these artists into the studio. And on the phone, you just heard Amy Gulick, who's a writer, photographer in Portland. Susan Watkins is with me, a painter and muralist. And Barbara Lydon, who's with the U.S. Forest Service. And part of her job is getting artists into the wilderness so that they can bring back images, bring back words that will inspire the rest of us. And there's a forum coming up next Tuesday, the 15th, at the Wilder Marston Theater at the Lusac Library, where there'll be more discussion about wilderness, how it inspires us. Susan will be there. I'll be moderating. And it's sponsored by a whole bunch of different agencies and organizations. And we talked a little bit in the first half about the Wilderness Act. And in the second half, we're going to talk more about that and also about creating the art, challenges of art, and how we see the world around us and turn it into to images that we can share, images and words. So please take with us for the second half, but right now we're going to take a break and do something different. Our producer, Monica Gokey, tracked down some audio from September 3rd, 1964, the day that Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Wilderness Preservation Act. And that was, of course, 50 years ago. So we're going to listen to that for a few minutes, and then we'll be back for the second half with the artists. Please stick with us. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth.
Members of the Cabinet and the Congress, ladies and gentlemen, this is a very happy and historic occasion for all who love the great American outdoors, and that, needless to say, includes me. The two bills that I'm signing this morning are in the highest tradition of our heritage as conservators as well as users of America's bountiful natural endowments. But Congress has done even more. Action has been taken to keep our air pure and our water safe and our food free from pesticides, to protect our wildlife, to conserve our precious water resources. No single Congress in my memory has done so much to keep America as a good and wholesome and beautiful place to live. I think it's significant that these steps have broad support, not just from the Democratic Party, but the Republican Party, both parties in the Congress. For example, the Wilderness Bill has been before the Congress since 1957. So it seems to me that this reflects a new and a strong national consensus to look ahead, and more than that, to plan ahead, and better still, to move ahead. We know that America cannot be made strong by leadership which reacts only to the needs or the irritations or the frustrations of the moment. True leadership must provide for the next decade and not merely the next day. So it's with a great deal of pride and pleasure and hope for the future that we enact into law today by signing these bills some of the most far-reaching conservation measures that a farsighted nation has ever coped with.
Listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 9 o'clock on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and I've really enjoyed today's conversation. We're talking about art in the wilderness. We chose the subject today in honor of the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Wilderness Act in 1964. You just heard Lyndon B. Johnson talking about that signing. That was really interesting. I never thought of him as being so articulate. I suppose he had good speech writers, but it was also nice to hear about the bipartisan nature of the passing of that bill and the hopefulness that existed in 1964. in a way, you think, you know, there was so much more wilderness in 1964 than there is now. On the flip side, you know, the environmental movement as we think of it today was really just getting started. You know, Silent Spring by Rachel Carson had recently been published, and the concerns were maybe not as partisan and heated as they are now, but also a lot of the major legislation hadn't even passed yet. 1964, there was a lot less parkland, a lot less wilderness designated sort of in Alaska than there is now. So interesting, a really interesting thing to look back on. And so we're looking at this through the perspective of art today. In the studio with me is Susan Watkins, who is a painter and muralist. She's working on a huge mural at the Bass Pro Shop, which is opening soon in Anchorage. I want to talk about that in the second half. Amy Gulick is a photographer and writer, the author of Salmon in the Trees, which is an extraordinarily beautiful book about the ecosystem of salmon in the rainforest. And Barbara Lydon is with me, too. She's with the U.S. Forest Service, a longtime wilderness ranger and coordinator of the Voices of Wilderness program. So, Barbara, the artists are taken out on these expeditions, which sound like an awful lot of fun, and I imagine there are many of our listeners who would like to apply. But they also have to produce something, and you end up with artwork that you can show, and I guess you're getting ready to do an exhibit of that work.
Yeah. So in exchange for the residency, artists donate a work of art to the hosting federal agency, and they also provide a community extension. And so from these residencies, we have a myriad of beautiful works of art. And I should mention that another thing that makes the residency unique is that it's open to multimedia. So it's not just painters and photographers, but we've had sculptors and writers, and we had a theater director. It's open to storytellers and dancers and musicians. So we've taken the works of art from the Voices of the Wilderness residencies, along with residencies that have occurred in other wilderness areas across Alaska. And we've put together a traveling art exhibit. And so this traveling exhibit is entitled Voices of the Wilderness. And it is currently in Sitka and will be traveling around Alaska throughout 2014. And so there's seven stops along the way. It's going to be leaving Sitka actually this week, heading to Ketchikan, Juneau, Fairbanks, Kenai, Homer, and culminating in Anchorage at the Anchorage Museum.
Okay, great. So it'll be traveling around our listening area. People should keep a lookout on it.
Absolutely.
So it ends up in Anchorage in November, did you say?
Yes, it'll be opening on November 21st, and it will be there through February 2015.
So in an art exhibit, you won't have dancers, presumably. I mean, you'll have mostly visual art, I would assume.
Yes, mostly visual. We also one of the pieces is a symphony composition that is it's viewed on an iPad along with images that go along with a 6-minute piece.
Wow, that is so neat.
The really fun thing about this traveling art exhibit is that it also is serving as a platform for other celebrations. So so it could provide a night of dancers to come in and have a presentation. But along the way, we have folks that are hosting slideshow presentations, wilderness film nights series. We have just all kinds of different things happening in each of the communities.
So you obviously have some selection process for choosing who will get this opportunity, which is something very precious that would be very expensive or difficult for folks to do on their own. Mm-hmm. How do you determine that the artists are, you know, have the merit that justifies sort of investing this resource? And how do you go through the process of people applying or do you invite them? How does that work?
Yeah, so there's an application process, and on the application, they have the they select which residencies interest them, and then there's some essay questions that ask them about what does Alaska wilderness mean to you? What are your values and questions that pertain to climate change and to stewardship? So we read through those. We look at artistic merit. And quite frankly, it's not an easy process. And so and throughout the years, it's just been gaining momentum. So each year we get more and more applicants, which makes it even more challenging.
Mm-hmm.
So then they go off to the individual wilderness managers throughout the state, whoever's hosting the residencies. And then each area has a small panel that then determines who will be the selected artist for the upcoming summer.
Wow. So, and it could be anywhere in Alaska, essentially, right? I mean, it's not only in Prince William Sound.
Exactly. Yeah. We have an opportunity this summer out in Western Arctic National Parklands where the artist will fly into Kotzebue and be part of a river patrol on the NOAA attack. We have opportunities down in Southeast Alaska and Tracy Iron Ford's Terror and South Baranof Wilderness. So it's all over the place. And the residencies kind of ebb and flow depending on budgets and staff. So last year, Glacier Bay National Park was with us and Misty Fjords was with us. So, you know, next year we might have three more residencies joining us. It's hard to say.
I assume there's no limitation on what the person expresses or how they express what they want to do. It's there. You're simply putting them there, and they create what they create.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, that's part of the application process. They propose a project mm-hmm. and a community extension. And what's been really fun is that the wilderness managers have been getting creative with the artists. So they look at the application, and often wilderness managers will then take a look at their educational goals that they're trying to meet but can't meet on their own for whatever reason, budgetary reasons or lack of skills. And we've been working with artists and to meet these goals. And in the process, we've had artists help us out with children's adventure guides, posters, websites, brochures, billboards. So lots of things that, the Forest Service could do, but not as creatively mm-hmm. as an artist can do. It says the same things that we would, it has the same messages that, say, the Forest Service would want to say, but it says it in a more creative, more attractive way.
Well, I'm sure you're very creative and attractive, too.
She is.
It's Outdoor Explorer, and I'm being silly. I'm Charles Woolforth, and that was Barbara Lydon, who's with the Forest Service and the Voices of the Wilderness program. Susan Watkins, I promised that we were going to let the listeners know something about how you paint a 100-foot mural of I guess is it the foothills north of the Brooks Range?
Mm-hmm.
So that's, that seems like such a daunting challenge. I can't even imagine how you go about it. What's the process of painting a mural that's that enormously large?
Just think big. I love it. I love a great big wall. It's very freeing. I just kind of see the whole thing, I guess, in my head.
Uh-huh.
And the size isn't really that much of a factor. You just kind of know, at least I kind of know what I need to fill that space. Start at one end and work out. Sometimes when I'm doing something that size, I have a goal too towards the end that I might want to finish a certain way, a mountain range, rock formations or whatever. So I know I'm working towards that. But along the way, then I put in the things, I guess, that work. You know, mm-hmm. make it work for that distance. It's just, I don't know, just taking something small and putting it big.
It seems like it's hard
to describe my process, but
it seems like you'd have to somehow change the scale of your brush strokes, because if you paint as you would on a small canvas, it would take you the rest of your life.
That's
right?
True.
So,
that's
and people
true.
Are going to see it from much farther away. So.
Correct. Yes, that's a good point, Charles. And again, it's a technique with your brush stroke, and I know many can relate to this, but where you're showing detail without really having to do it so much. It's more just the light and the shadow and the quick twist of a brush mm-hmm. in certain colors.
Do you paint other subjects than nature?
Mm-hmm. I do. I like to paint. I like to do still lifes. Primarily, I like nature and landscapes, but I do people. mm-hmm. in certain settings, mm-hmm. and in many different styles of painting, because I've painted in hospitals and for extended care facilities, children's units, trauma units, here in Alaska and other places. So sometimes I will gear something down to, you know, for a child or mm-hmm. a child's idea. And then earlier in the year, I painted a wine cellar so to make it look like you were down inside the wine cellar. This was for the Captain Cook Hotel.
Oh, neat.
So it's like a lot of different, you know, to me, it's more like taking a while and changing the space. You know, in a hospital, it's taking that while and deinstitutionalizing it and making it, you know, like an environment somewhere else.
Well, you know, a lot of artists, contemporary artists, aren't that concerned with beauty, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like your work is really conveying beauty and creating something that will give people pleasure and put them in a sense of a peaceful or positive
yes,
frame of mind.
Take them somewhere else.
Uh-huh.
And that's, I have a background in healthcare as well. And so initially I started my mural work through doing work in hospitals
mm-hmm.
and ran some programs at Cancer Center where the patients were involved with doing the murals for different times of the year. We had the four seasons and they could work on a season that kind of reflected where they were in their life, you know, with their treatment process. Maybe it was spring with hope or maybe it was, you know, winter solitude, thinking about things. So I've kind of used my mural work along the way to kind of reach out to people like that, too.
Oh, that's really...
Children in an environment, like one example is a pediatric unit, where they might not get out of there anytime soon. So the idea was, you know, the imaginary forest and then taking them down a path and maybe following the rabbit from Alice in Wonderland with the, you know, the little pocket watch. Remember that?
Yeah.
maybe they could see that they were going somewhere else.
That's neat.
Through the artwork.
Trying to create a uh-huh. frame of mind in the viewer that's positive for where they need to be. Yeah. You know, Amy was talking earlier about
that.
Amy was talking about how doing these trips puts her in a frame of mind of that's more conducive to creation, which is. And I certainly have felt this, and I've written about it, this sense that you get out there and slowly your mind moves away from sort of the hour-to-hour day, way we break mm-hmm. up our days and the way we think sort of linear one thing after another into sort of a much more holistic way of viewing the world. Do you find that your art and the way you perceive and the way you create is affected by being away from the city?
Absolutely. It's a detoxification. That's mm-hmm. the way I feel. It takes the chaos out of life. It's just focusing what is around you, and then your basic needs, your food, your water, where you're going to sleep that night. And that's it. You know, it's so simple.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, like Amy said earlier, it's very peaceful to me. It's very calming. It's very, you know, kind of like grounding again.
Yeah. I feel so sorry for people who don't have that in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also always have this feeling when I come back to the city after a long time out in the wilderness of like, oh my gosh, do we really live in this ugly, ugly, busy place, right? Is this like...
Exactly.
Yeah. So Amy Gulick is down in Portland, and she's the author and photographer of the beautiful book, Salmon in the Trees, published by Braided River Press. Amy, you were talking about getting in that frame of mind. On the other hand, you're also working with technical equipment and having to think about setting up a shot and what shot you're going after. Tell us how that works. Because there's this technical aspect of art. It's not all sort of beauty and you know, the airy-fairy sort of part that we'd like to think of, right? There's a lot of work and technical know-how involved in painting and writing and photography.
Right, exactly. But, you know, I think any artist, the more familiar you are and the more versed you are in the technical aspects of whatever craft you're working in, the more time you can spend in that wonderful creative space. And I do teach basic photography workshops, and that's what I'm always trying to help beginners learn. It's like, you know, there's two sides of your brain, and you're kind of doing this dance between the two sides, and whatever, whether it's painting, photography, sculpture. And again, the more versed you are in the technical parts of things, they just become second nature. Like, so when I'm out there, I'm not looking down at the camera and fiddling around with shutter speeds and apertures and things like that. It's just that is so secondhand to me that I make the adjustments I need to make without really thinking about them, and that allows me to just be in the space that I would rather be in, and that's that creative space. And I will say, I think wilderness, you know, getting back on what we were just talking about, kind of like a frame of mind, I think while wilderness is certainly a geographic place, it's also a mind space. And even when I'm not out in you know, a wonderful wilderness area, if I can, and for me, this is what art does, you know, I can look at either my photographs or Susan's paintings or, you know, really any kind of art that, say, was inspired or came out of somebody's experience in wilderness, and my mind is it's there. And when I say it's there, I'm meaning it's in the present. And for me, I think that is the most positive thing that I get from wilderness, is just living in the present. You know, in this modern world that we've created, while wonderful in many ways, in other ways it's very artificial. And I think the things that we're all running around stressing about day to day, whether we're sitting at a desk and looking at a computer, or sitting in traffic looking at other people, or rushing to get from one place to the other, and I mean, that's what fills a lot of our lives, and a lot of that's kind of artificial. And I think wilderness, being out in wilderness, or looking at art again that's inspired from wilderness, I think puts us back into this very natural place in our own minds, and it's the place that we all came from, and it's the most natural place where I think that we are most at home, whether we realize that or not. Again, in today's kind of crazy world that we've created.
Well, it's almost you get out there and you realize that what matters is the tide rising and the tide falling, and all that other stuff you thought mattered really isn't very important. Whatever is on Facebook or on your phone.
Exactly. It's totally irrelevant, and for me, that's really what wilderness has taught me over the years. That really, the only life that matters is the one that you have right now. Mm-hmm. And when I'm out in wilderness, I'm not thinking about what I did 5 years ago, and I'm not even thinking about what I'm going to have for dinner that night, because it doesn't matter at that moment. And those moments can be different, right? They can be a moment where you've got a brown bear, you know, just a few steps away from you. So you're really not going to be thinking about anything else but right then. Or it can be a very peaceful moment, you know, where you're sitting next to, you know, the largest tidewater glacier in North America, and just trying to take all that in. So there are different moments out there,
but it seems to me that, I think that's true. But I also think as an artist or a writer, one of the things that I've recognized is I'm in this incredible place. I can't possibly really convey the place to the reader. It's too big, and it's too much of it, and it's not something that can flow through transparently from a place through words to the person's mind. But I can convey my frame of mind and how the place affects me, and pick out certain details that put me in that frame of mind, and perhaps find analogs in the reader's mind that will put them in that frame of mind, which I think is a little bit following what you're saying, Amy, in terms of what is this place, how does it affect you, is really more important than exactly what's in front of you.
Right, exactly. And you know, for many years, you know, I've been doing wilderness, you know, travel for decades, and for many years I used to view wilderness as an escape, you know, an escape from this, again, this crazy kind of modern world that we've created. And now I don't view it as an escape. I view it as like the most natural place. And what I mean by place, again, it could be a geographic place, or it's just a state of mind. It's the most natural place where I think we can be. And back when I used to view wilderness as an escape, and I look back at a lot of the art I was creating and the photographs I was creating back then, and I didn't want any people in my images. I didn't want, you know, I didn't even want, you know, a kayak or a tent or anything like that, because, again, to me, that kind of broke up that state of mind that I was in, which was kind of an escape. And now I'm finding I really want people in the photograph, because I want to help people feel like they're in that space that I was in when I created the photograph. And I think people can relate to a place and that state of mind if they see a person experiencing it. And so it's just similar to what you just said about writing about it. If you can convey how you felt when you were there, and if you do that through words or a painting or a photograph, then I think that helps other people feel like they're there. And as an artist, I feel incredibly you know, fortunate to be in these places and experience and see what are perfectly natural things, but that most people don't get the opportunity to experience.
And we need to leave it there, I'm afraid, because we've run out of time. And I do want to let people know about this panel that's coming up on Tuesday the 15th at the Lusac Library. We'll be talking more about these topics, and that begins at 6 o'clock on the 15th. I want to thank my guest, Amy Gulick, you just were hearing from. She's the author and photographer of Salmon in the Trees from Braided River Press. We also heard from Susan Watkins, a painter and muralist here in Anchorage. She's working on a huge painting at the Bass Pro Shop, which I'm looking forward to seeing. And Barbara Lydon from the U.S. Forest Service, coordinator of the Voices of Wilderness Project, who helped us put all this together. Great show. Thanks so much, all of you.
Thank you.
Next week, next week, we're talking about getting ready for paddling season. There's a event that's going to be happening soon with the canoeists and kayakers on the 17th. We'll be talking about all the stuff you need to know for the season that's ahead. Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Monica Gokey. I'm your host, Charles Wolforth, and I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.